Okay. Are we on? Hello? Okay. The date, April 24th, 1984. David Dvorkin and Alan Needell presiding with
Jerry Connor from Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Okay. And that sounds just fine. That's the whole point of this. Well, could you tell me, Dr. Connor, a little bit about your early home life, development of your professional interests?
Very well. I grew up in the country in northeast Texas, about halfway between Dallas and Texarkana. From my very early days, I was not very interested in farming. On the other hand, I was quite interested in not scientific at that time, but technical kinds of things. One of my friends had an interest in a ham radio activity and had been able to pull together a limited amount of equipment, and that really intrigued me a great deal. I thought that was great fun. When my father worked on the car or the farm machinery, I was always getting in his way. So ever since I remember, I've been interested in technical things.
Did he allow you to help out, or did he show you what he was doing, or did you go?
Well, I think both is the right answer. I certainly got in the way, but he was pretty good to tell me what he was doing and show me what he was doing. So I was able to get a feel for the things he did right from an early age. He was not only a farmer, he was the community blacksmith as well. So he had a small blacksmith shop, and I would go into the blacksmith shop and hammer on things.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
No.
Okay.
One sister died before I was born. Okay. So I was raised as an only child.
What were the educational levels of your mother and your father?
My mother finished eighth grade, and my father, I'm not even quite sure, but less than that, something like fifth grade in public school.
Was your mother at home then constantly, or did she have any outside activities?
No outside activity. A farm life. Mm-hmm. Both mother and father worked very hard on the farm, and she would work in the field, but in that sense she was working outside the home, meaning house, but it was all part of the same operation.
Reminds me of Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, but that's, I guess, West Texas.
Yes, right.
Yeah. In your upbringing, is there a point in time when it became evident that you were going to go through a formal schooling procedure, or did your parents, how would you characterize your parents' support of education? Were they for it, or did they try to encourage you to do something else?
No, from the very earliest time that I can remember, my mother had just a driving concern, very hard driving concern, that I go to college. Now, going to college when I was growing up and in that community was a relatively rare thing for a poor farm boy. And so it was an open issue as to whether they and I, in some sense, would be able to pull that off. And I don't remember being very concerned about it. She was much more concerned about it than I was when I was quite young.
By not being concerned, you mean you would have been happy to stay on the farm and be a farmer or a rancher?
I don't think I ever made a conscious decision of that sort. I think it was just something for the future that I didn't quite have to worry about at that time. I poked around doing interesting things when I didn't have to work. Incidentally, my folks were really very very tolerant of me and allowed me a lot of free time on the farm rather than making me work every waking minute, which was a lot of some of the farm children in that community. I can remember a few things to illustrate my interest in technical matters from fairly early age, like when I was 9 or 10 years old, I read something about the way coal gas is made. And since my father had a blacksmith shop, he had coal, and I went out and took a tin can and crushed some coal and put it in it and heated it over a fire and put a tube in the can with clay and off to some distance and discovered I could make it burn, mm-hmm. the gas that was driven off, and other things of that sort. It, my interest wasn't focused too much. I was also interested in ants and worms and things of that sort as well. So,
did you have stimulus from friends or from teachers in school?
I don't think I had very much stimulus from friends, except for my one friend who was trying to get together enough of radio material to have a ham radio station. Mm-hmm. And he put me in contact with some of his friends and people who had more of that sort of equipment. But I never had very much scientific stimulus from other friends.
Who was this one person, and did he go on to be a scientist of any sort?
No, he didn't. Well, yes, he did. His name is Homer Dale Milford.
Homer Dale?
Milford.
Milford, okay.
Yes, he was a year or two older than I. He went on to become a meteorologist. Mm-hmm. And after he grew up, he became a representative from the state of Texas in the U.S. Congress, as a matter of fact. And I think only served one term. He did not like the lifestyle too well.
Okay, what about teachers, though? Can you point to any one or two teachers in your high school or even previous who were influential in your career?
I always got along pretty well with my teachers. I, in fact, part of the time had a reputation of being teacher's pet because I would do things the teachers liked for their students to do, like not cause problems and do the homework and things like that.
Subversive,
yes. On the other hand, I don't remember any teachers until perhaps the ninth grade or thereabouts who had any particular scientific interest. In fact, not even then. There was a teacher at that time who was principal of the two-room schoolhouse I was going to up until about ninth grade, who had a very broad scope of interest, and he was interested in a lot of things, including the subjects he taught in school, but sports and so forth. And I played basketball on the school team. At any rate, he and I got along just great, and he encouraged me a lot in whatever it was I was interested in. I'm sure had it been biology or had it been almost anything else, he would have encouraged me. But he didn't have any great depth of knowledge or training, I think, in the sciences. So I can remember when I got too old to go to the country school for 10th grade, I went then to high school in Commerce, Texas, by bus.
What year was that, approximately?
Must have been 1930. It was either 39 or 40. Let me think. The war with Japan broke out in December of 1941, mm-hmm. and we had just moved from the farm community to Port Arthur, which is a few hundred miles away and is on the coast, mm-hmm. still in Texas, close to Louisiana.
Was your father still a farmer at that point?
He had been a farmer up until a few months before, up until the spring before, and because the country was gearing up already at that time, wait one moment.
That's all right.
We moved to Port Arthur, I'm pretty sure, in the spring of 1941. He had found a job in a construction industry building an oil refinery in Port Arthur.
This is partly from his background as a blacksmith.
It was just an opportunity to get out of farming. He had tried farming, and he preferred farming for a long time, but it was a very hard life, and he wasn't doing very well financially in farming. I didn't find this out until sometime after I grew up, but he was somewhat heavily in debt because of repeated farm problems, failures, whatever. And I can get at this maybe another way. We moved to Port Arthur when I was 15 years old. And I was born in 1927. That must be 1939 then, when we moved to Port Arthur.
And,
I said 1942.
Just after the Pearl Harbor.
Just after the, mm-hmm. the Pearl Harbor thing. That has to be it. And my father had gotten this job like late in the spring, after the spring planting had been done, and my mother and I stayed on the farm for a couple of months until we could sell our our interest in the farm. Now, we did not own the farm, we rented it, but the crop was ours, and we were able finally to sell it, and then my mother and I went to Port Arthur. Another way I can be sure that it was after the war started is that rationing was already in, and we had very poor tires on our car, and I had to drive it, and we had several problems in getting from where we lived to Port Arthur.
Now, during this time, you were going to high school.
Yes.
Had you been bused to the 10th grade before that time, or 10th grade came after you went to
school? No, the 10th grade came before that time.
Yeah.
The last grade at that time was 11th grade. Now it's 12, but at that time it was 11. And I did that last year in Port Arthur in Texas. My final high school year was in Port Arthur.
Can you identify that period as a period when you became specifically interested in any career goals, or were you still?
Yes, I began to realize that that the time was coming pretty soon, especially when I was still on the farm, when this question about whether I would go to college at all or not was approaching fairly soon. Mm-hmm. What was typical then for those farm boys and girls who did go to college was to go to the local college in Commerce, which at that time was the East Texas State Teachers College. It's now part of the University of Texas system, but it's located at Commerce, a small community there in East Texas. And that was about 10 miles from where we lived on the farm. It didn't seem likely that I would, I hadn't focused on what I would study in college when I was still on the farm. After moving to Port Arthur, it looked very much more likely that I could go to college then. Somehow being in a city rather than on the farm made that seem more feasible. By that time, I had an uncle who lived in Humble near Houston.
How do you spell that?
Humble, H-U-M-B-L-E.
Okay.
Humble, Texas, near Houston. He had worked for the Houston Light and Power Company. He was a great promoter of Rice Institute at the time, Rice University now, and he had started to work on my father and mother to try to send me to Rice the last year or two. And my mother was very enthusiastic about that. And it worked out that way, as a matter of fact.
How were you funded at Rice?
I was funded because I could live at home. After living in Port Arthur for less than a year, my father was transferred to the Houston area, as a matter of fact, and his job. The construction company completed the project in Port Arthur, and they had another one going in Houston, and my father had to go over there. It was luck. There was a great deal of luck involved in all of this. And my mother and father moved over there. At the very time we moved, just after I graduated from high school, Rice went on a three-semester-per-year cycle because they had a naval ROTC contingent there, and that had built up greatly, and they were trying to now get the naval boys educated. And so I went right into school within, a month. I think it was in July of that year, which was 1943 then, when I graduated from Port Arthur, moved to Houston, went right into Rice. The total cost of going to Rice was very minimal in those days. There was no tuition, and fees were very modest. And I think for like $200, I went to Rice, and I lived at home. So it all worked out. You know, the present-day problem of financing children in college just was non-existent then.
When did you first declare a major?
I went in with the idea that I wanted to be a chemical, a chemist, or a chemical engineer, or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. And so...
Coal gasification.
Yes. Was that part of it, or...?
I had just thought that chemistry was science, mm-hmm. I think, is the best way to describe it, but at that point. In high school, I'd taken
petroleum engineering, or...
Yes, petroleum was very interesting, but from the standpoint of petroleum chemistry, yeah. Not petroleum extraction of mm-hmm. oil and so forth from the ground.
Had you read books by this time that dealt with science?
Yes.
And popular journals? Could you name a few that you did? Such as Popular Science.
The books I had read... I had read surely some journals and books about radio and ham radio. I had read books about mostly more chemistry oriented than anything else by that time, and I can't remember the names of them. I had a chemistry course at Commerce in high school and a physics course in Port Arthur in high school. In the chemistry course, I had a good teacher who was very inspiring, and he really covered a lot of territory of great breadth in chemistry. The physics course in Port Arthur was not very good. In fact, I got thrown out of class once.
For what reason? But
just because it was so boring, and I was not alone. That was not a unique honor. It was just that the entire student or entire class was not at all favorable toward that course, and the teacher was not very good, and we got crossways is what it amounts to, and we all got thrown out is what I really should have said.
Okay, considering that we don't have too much time, let me identify a few milestones.
All right.
You went in chemistry. Did you turn to physics at any time during that time at Rice?
Yes, I went into chemistry the first year, and by the second year, I began to realize that physics was more fun, and I declared I changed from chemistry to physics sometime during the second year. It was in the middle.
What made it more fun?
Just the subject material. The
did you take
things
both a physics course and a chemistry course first year at Rice?
Yes, I did, and the second year as well. And thereafter, I tended to concentrate for physics. After 2 years, I went off to the Navy for a while. I got 2 years in a year and a quarter of calendar time because we were in three semesters per year at that time. And by the time I had left, it was clear I liked physics better than chemistry and made a change. And it was no problem. All I had to do was just say I wanted to do that, and that was all there was to it.
Oh, yeah, Rice. What about your... how did you get into the Navy? Did you do anything of specialized nature?
Yes. The Navy had a program of kind of a special allowance for people with a little bit of technical training and with an interest in being radio and radar technicians. And I applied to that and was accepted into that, into the Naval Radio and Radar Training course, with the idea then I would be a technician in that area. And one was able to sign on as a seaman first class rather than common seaman or whatever the term was. In other words, it was a couple of grades up already going in. And that looked attractive. And so I volunteered into that course in the Navy rather than waiting a few months and being drafted. I went in when I was 17 and a half or thereabouts.
So this was a technical but operational position. Did you actually see duty in the Pacific?
Well, the way I like to say that is that after I received my training and was put on assignment, I never got in an airplane and I never got on a ship.
What did you do?
We completed the training course just as the war was over. And there was no need then to send me out to active duty. Rather, all of the bases and stations and temporary bases were being decommissioned. People were shipping things home head over heels. I was sent to Norfolk, Virginia, and assigned to the warehouse department because I could sort out the parts. I knew what all the parts were. I could read the color codes on the resistors and capacitors and chokes and so forth, and I could sort those out. And as you might imagine, people who were coming home were eager to come home, and that stuff just got dumped into barrels, totally unsorted, maybe something like you're familiar with, right?
You've seen our restoration facility.
And I spent the rest of my time in the Navy then, which was a little less than a year.
Well, if you ever need another position.
Sorting out electronic components.
How did you feel about that?
I was disappointed. I wanted to get assigned on a ship. Actually, I went into naval aircraft electronics.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two reasons. One, I thought that would be more interesting. And two, the training school for that was in Corpus Christi, which was only a little over 200 miles from home. And by that time, I'd met Anne and was interested in seeing her whenever I could.
Mm-hmm.
Did you meet her at Rice?
No,
I met her in Houston, but not at Rice.
Okay.
I met her at church in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And
what church?
The Church of Christ.
Okay.
The one that's gained a certain amount of fame recently for their little community in Collinsville, Oklahoma, I think.
Yeah.
A very fundamentalist church. But each church is independent of all the others.
Uh-huh. I see.
And at any rate, I went there and I went to that school in Corpus Christi and then was assigned to Norfolk.
Were you disappointed that you didn't have a more technical position besides that?
Yes, I was disappointed.
Did you learn much in the training courses?
In the training courses, I learned a great deal. I thought that was just really invaluable and have applied it, well, not recently, but over a good bit of my continuing professional career, even after going back to Rice and completing a physics degree and getting a work at Los Alamos in physics, I continued to have a strong electronic slant for a long time in what I did. I liked it and I wanted to do it myself, but I haven't done that now in some time.
It sounds like your experience in training in the war, certainly your training, was important in your later
career. It was very important, right. Mm-hmm. And it made completion of the work I did in graduate school very much easier because I could fiddle with the instruments myself and make them work.
When you returned to Rice to complete your physics degree, did you begin to specialize in one particular part of physics at that time?
Not as an undergraduate. I did both undergraduate and graduate work at Rice.
Mm-hmm.
As an undergraduate, I did not specialize, and we had only really two parts of the department there. There was nuclear physics and there was low temperature physics.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, in fact, before the low temperature physics part of the department was established, they hired a couple of professors and just made an explicit decision to have a low temperature physics activity, research. And
was that under the impetus of Navy interests? Or?
No, I don't believe so. Well, I can't say for sure. It was not my perception that it was anything except to broaden the department, the scope of the department in physics. It had been almost entirely nuclear physics up until that point, as far as the research activities were concerned.
What were your particular leanings as an undergraduate? Did you want to go into one or the other? Were you
As an undergraduate, yes, even as an undergraduate, after I returned from the war, I was leaning toward nuclear physics all along. And when I became a graduate, that's what I did. I took up nuclear physics research.
Can you point to any one thing about nuclear physics or to one of your professors that you can identify as something that pushed you in that direction?
Well, you've got to know that the reason the war ended when it did had to do with nuclear physics, and that caught my imagination just as it did a lot of other people, and just really generated a lot of interest. And when I went back, there was just no question that...
Can you remember reading the Smythe Report on the Manhattan Project, or can you remember how you learned about our reactors or the weapons or...
I learned about the nuclear bomb, like everyone else did, in the newspaper, the radio.
Did you feel you understood what it was?
Oh, yeah. It was not difficult to understand. And that's immediately what I tried to go into as soon as I went back to school. In fact, when I went into graduate school, one of the very first projects that I got involved with was to measure some cross-sections that were important to nuclear reactions, the deuterium-tritium cross-section.
Right, right. Deuterium and tritium and things like that.
Yeah, right. And that's, you know, that's the thermonuclear reaction important in weapons associated things.
Who were your professors?
Undergraduate professors were Heaps, H-E-A-P-S. The low temperature professor was Squires.
Squires. Okay.
Squires, I think with an S, but I'm not sure. The old chairman of the department who came back and taught a few courses was Wilson. He was the original physics department at Rice. And he was fortunately still around, very white-haired and frail by that time, but still around when I was there. Ritter. Well, perhaps that's enough.
I'm curious.
And Bonner. Bonner was the chairman of the department, in fact, and was my advisor in nuclear physics in graduate school.
Just after the turn of the century, a man named Lovett became president of Rice.
Right.
He was an astronomer from Princeton. And yet, astronomy didn't grow at Rice to any degree.
That's right.
And I'm just wondering if, you know, while you were there, your association with it, there was any interest in astronomy at all, or you could explain why astronomy didn't grow.
My impression is that there was very little interest, and I certainly have no knowledge myself of why it didn't grow. It just was not a subject we talked about very much, except in a very generalized way. I think that in the physics, undergraduate physics coursework that I did, we probably covered astronomy as one chapter or something like that. It just did not get any emphasis.
There was no faction of the physics department or astronomer trying to beat out of the box. It just didn't exist, to the best of your knowledge.
Not to my knowledge.
Now, the choice to go to graduate school at Rice, did you have other choices?
I thought that I should try because it seemed like the thing to do, to look at other graduate schools. But Tom Bonner came around, in fact, and kind of twisted my arm before I had really gone very far, wanting me to stay, offering me a fellowship, and I just capitulated without really pursuing other choices. So I'd never had another formal choice, but I believe that was probably because I did not pursue it.
Where would you place yourself in your graduating class ranking among your physics colleagues?
In the regular graduation, the fourth year graduation.
Yeah, yeah. You know, not an exact numerical level.
Right.
But,
I would say high, but I not one or two, but also well above 50% time.
Can you recall, the one or two outstanding people and what happened to them?
Not right now. I have no memory.
A more general question. Did you find most of your graduate student colleagues getting more and more interested in nuclear physics? And did this cause any dissension in the department among the low-temperature physicists?
I'm not sure I understood that question right. I don't recall very much dissension. I think, as I said, there was a very conscious decision to have a low-temperature department and to give it a reasonable amount of support. And I'm sure there was competition for funds and things of that sort, but it was supported quite well.
What about for students?
But for students.
And for students, I wasn't aware that there was any real competition there. It was smaller than the nuclear physics, but even in nuclear physics, there were not very many students, perhaps 8 or 10 students at that time, and only 4 or 5, I believe, in the low temperature.
Okay. You mentioned that you worked on cross-sections of deuterium and tritium. Did this eventually come into a thesis, or what did you...
It's part of my thesis. I had three topics for my thesis, and the deuterium-tritium cross-section was one of them. This is at very low energy, lower than it had been measured up until that point in time, although I was working neck and neck with a group at Los Alamos trying to do the same thing. And as an aside, an interesting aside, which I have the impression you guys love, Tom Bonner literally carried in his pocket a cubic centimeter of tritium gas back from Los Alamos on an airplane to Rice. And it was with that cubic centimeter of tritium gas, a radioactive material, that he carried in his pocket that I and several other people did a lot of research projects on at Rice. And that was okay in those days. That wasn't illegal. He was, it was given to him to use at Rice. Yeah. He had a lot of stature at Los Alamos.
Did he have a sense of the danger of carrying it in his pocket?
Oh, yes. He was a fairly careful man, in fact, about tritium and other radioactive materials and other hazardous materials, as a matter of fact. And
He carried it in his pocket?
It's my impression he carried it in his coat pocket. Not as a bare glass vial. It was in a glass vial. He had it packed very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Did he work at Los Alamos during the war?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And do you know which...
And after the war, he worked during the summers at Los Alamos.
I see. Was it the T Division? Do you know?
I don't know. Well, he was always an experimentalist.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As you were.
Very much experimentalist, as I was.
What was the role of theory at Rice? Was it emphasized?
In my view, it was not emphasized. We carried our work to the point where we would try usually matching experimental results in some appropriate theory, but not in any penetrating way. That is, we'd take the results of theory and try to see if that would work with our data. But we did not develop theory. Not at that time, we did not develop theory. Later on, we did get a theoretician at Rice, a man named Wagner, I believe.
Okay. Now, as in identifying your thesis interests, obviously going to nuclear physics, you've also identified a very strong connection between Bonner and Los Alamos.
Yes.
Did this lead to your going to Los Alamos immediately after, or what did you do?
Well, it certainly led to me being aware of Los Alamos and having a pretty good understanding of what went on there, and it sounded like it was kind of right down my alley. That's exactly what I was interested in.
Did you travel there as a graduate student?
No, I didn't. Not as a graduate student until I was about ready to finish work and look for a job.
Was your thesis work classified?
No. Let me think. I actually got a clearance while I was at Rice because it was an issue about whether the DT cross-sections were going to be classified or not.
And this was an AECQ clearance?
And it was an AECQ clearance that I got at Rice. Right.
Was all of this funded by AEC or ONR? Or just by Rice?
I guess I don't know where the funds came from. As far as my own fellowship was concerned, after the first 2 years, I got a formal AEC fellowship rather than a Rice fellowship out of Oak Ridge. I spent a day filling out questionnaires and tests and so forth.
Just a day.
And I did have a fellowship in the last 2 years, an AEC fellowship.
Well, could you describe then the transition from being a graduate student to your first position?
First job at Los Alamos?
Yeah.
I did interview at Shell, at Mobil in Dallas, and at Rice, and one other place, which was turned out to be a chemical manufacturing company, and I discovered I wasn't interested in that. I clearly decided for Los Alamos, and as it turned out, that was the lowest offer in terms of salary that I got, but it was by far the most attractive. Mm-hmm. They invited me out for an interview. I loved the country, the mountains and the relatively dry condition. After living in Houston, you can understand that perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just no question but that was where I wanted to go. So I did go there. I was put in a small group in the physics division, which was the experimental physics division. Nuclear physics was mostly what was done at that time. and our group had a small Cockcroft-Walton accelerator.
I see.
Yeah, you better write that one down.
I know how to spell that.
And the Cockcroft-Walton was used mostly to generate neutrons by using the DT reaction. So we made tritium targets and accelerated deuterons and made neutrons. And we had a fairly intense source, and if you ask me how intense, I don't remember.
It's all right. I'm more interested in the atmosphere for research and the attitudes of what was going to be the role of Los Alamos in the future,
mm-hmm.
And what you personally wanted to do. Were you interested in basic research as you went there?
Yes. As I went there, I was interested in basic research. I've always had an interest, however, in seeing a research applied. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite the ivory tower scientist who would be negative about having some research applied. I would like to see it applied. I thought nuclear physics was an ideal field of research that had a lot of application, hopefully to other things than bombs. By that time, of course, I knew about nuclear power, nuclear reactors, radioisotope usage for tracers, and other applications. So I thought it was a very exciting field, had a lot of research potential, and had a lot of application potential. So that was what attracted me to nuclear physics.
Did you know where your group's work fit in? I mean, you were making neutrons. Were you also doing the cross-section measurements with those neutrons, or was another group using your neutrons?
No. We did the research then with our facility. We weren't just a service facility. Mm-hmm. We were both, as a matter of fact. We did research with the neutrons. We measured cross-sections, angular distributions, scattering cross-sections, total cross-sections, and I did a bit of that work.
And this is all within the same group?
All within the same group. The neutron source was used as a facility for other people also to do research, including biologists who would bring mice and expose them to the neutrons, to people doing certain kinds of fission research with the energetic neutrons, the thermonuclear neutrons, 14 MeV neutrons mm-hmm. from a DT reaction. We did mostly DT neutrons, only a very small amount of D neutrons, which are much lower energy. So it was an exciting time. You said, what was the atmosphere like? I thought it was exciting. Now, no doubt it wasn't nearly as exciting as it had been some years earlier, but it was still, to me, very exciting.
What was the year you went there?
1952. I went there in July of 1952.
So this was already past the crisis at Los Angeles.
It had already passed the crisis, just what I was about to say. So the future of Los Alamos seemed assured at that point in time. It didn't seem to be an issue anymore, and there was not really very much talk about what the future of Los Alamos was to be.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of the mic tests and the...
Oh, yes. Well, the mic test was in 52, the very year I went there. I was later able to go out and see the hole in the ground or filled with water, but not immediately.
Was your group specifically involved in applied tasks related to those tests?
No, not in any direct way. Our group was doing work that at least was heavily oriented toward what I'll call supporting research, kind of general basic research that was more background information or general information that was, I hope, useful in the weapons program, but it was not to develop specific weapons or solve specific weapons problems for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe we should go on and sort of schematize the rest.
Okay, we only have about 15 minutes left on our schedule that we're sort of stuck to.
All right.
But I think we'd like to know from you if you could provide a schematic of how your group, how you migrated through your groups, the chief people you worked with, and how you or the VELA program began.
Oh, how
did you get into X-ray?
Starting with VELA.
From where we are now.
Okay.
This was in 1952.
Right.
In after the Sputnik launch. When? It was 57, I think, right?
So you continue on pretty much in this
pretty
kind
much
of work
in this vein
through Sputnik.
Okay, except for one occasion when I was loaned to the test division at Los Alamos and spent 2 or 3 months working for them first at Los Alamos and then in the Pacific for about 2 months on a test series called Red Wing, which was in 1956. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me ask one. Go ahead.
And that was then. Then I came back, went right back into the same group, and continued.
And your position in that group remained
staff member. Same position, all along.
You know, but as staff member, I know the way groups work. Some groups, everyone is able to do everything. Other groups, people really are specialists and provide crucial expertise. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize your group that you were in, and what was your expertise?
There was a pretty good breadth for most of us in the group. We both contributed to keeping the machine running, this Cockcroft Walton. Running, we did repair work, we changed targets, we did whatever was necessary to keep the machine running, and we also carried on experiments. Most of us had something to do of our own, so to speak, but we would use each other a great deal.
By the way, what did you call your group? Cockcroft Walton Group.
I'm not sure it had a name other than that, except for an administrative name. It was called P4, which just means the fourth group in the physics division.
And how big was it?
It was very small. It was probably 8 to 10 people then.
Were you particularly a problem solver or a fire putter outer or a designer or what? How would you characterize you?
I really enjoyed working on the machine. I spent probably most of my time either fixing the machine or building something new for the machine, a new control of some sort.
And who was the group leader?
A man named James Coon, C-O-O-N.
Okay. Now, let's go to the Sputnik era.
And Sputnik, everything stayed the same up till...
Everything stayed the same. And there was Sputnik, and everything, of course, still stayed the same in our group.
That's important to determine, yeah.
But there began to be... an interest throughout the country, and that included Los Alamos, of trying to do more things in space. People in certain areas had already been interested in doing this, of course, but it wasn't nearly as general. And suddenly Los Alamos, people in Los Alamos, what can we do? And a small group of people started getting together already in 57 or 58, certainly by 58, trying to think of experiments to do in space. And
can you identify those people? Were you one of them?
I was not one of them at that point in time. One of them was a man named Harold Argo.
Who?
Harold Argo, A-R-G-O.
Okay.
John Northrop. Mm-hmm. Samuel Bame, B-A-M-E. B-A-M-E.
Simply. B-A-M-E, okay.
Sam Bain.
One very quick aside.
Let me turn the tape over.
Okay.